Good to see everyone. This morning for our study, we're in Matthew chapter 5. I'm going to read verses 21 through 26. We'll be talking about verses 23 through 26, but I'll read verse 21 and 22 as well. You have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment." But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, "Raca," shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, "You fool," shall be in danger of hell fire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. When we were looking at verses 17 to 20, we learned a couple of things. Number one, Christ said that he came to fulfill the law. And secondly, he said, unless our righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, we cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. And those are two very important guidelines and rules for us. Christ came to fulfill the law. And one thing he is going to point out is how watered down the law had become in the hands of the Pharisees and scribes. They were far from teaching all of the implications of the law of God. Man's tendency is to make things easier, to water things down, to dumb things down. When I was in grade school over in Ludlow, I think the education I got, eighth grade, would be equivalent today of a high school seniors' education, maybe a college freshman's education. I had such wonderful teachers. We had such in-depth studies, difficult studies, homework. We had it all. And I would think maybe a college freshman would have had a hard time today keeping up with my eighth grade back then. But that's not to brag about my eighth grade education. 60 years or so before I went to eighth grade, eighth graders in this country were being taught Latin and Greek. That was just part of the curriculum for grade school back then. So what I studied had been dumbed down, and what kids are studying today, I guarantee you will be dumbed down. The test I took back then, the SAT, ACT, it's no secret. They have been dumbed way down. So it seems like our education system is still doing a good job when it's not. We've just made things easier. That's what the rabbis had done with the law of Moses. They had made things easier. They had dumbed down the law of God. Christ was going to correct that by fulfilling the law, showing what is involved in God's word. And then Christ says, except our righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. That's like saying, unless you do a better job at living a Christian life than your favorite preacher has done, better than some Greek scholar or Bible teacher has done, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. The scribes and Pharisees were thought to be the epitome of piety and godliness. Christ says, you're going to have to do better than they. And then starting in verse 21 and following through to the end of the chapter, he's going to give illustrations of what he's talking about. And the first thing he takes up is the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. And I think the reason he begins with the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not murder, is because the gospel story ends with a murder and a killing. The murder of the Son of God. The judicial execution of the Son of God. And Christ in verses 21 and 22 is going to show us what the command, thou shalt not kill, meant before it was dumbed down by the Pharisees and scribes. What did God mean when he told Moses, and Moses told Israel, thou shalt not kill? Well, we have an autopsy of murder contained in verses 21 and 22. If I was going to dissect the act of murder, I would say there are five things involved in murder. The first begins with our first sin. I don't remember my first sin. You probably don't remember yours, but early on in my life, I did something I knew I shouldn't have done. I did something I knew was wrong. And I got away with it. Maybe I just refused to eat my vegetables that Mom had put in front of me for dinner. Maybe I'd done something as innocent as that, but it was an act of defiance by me. And there were no repercussions. There were no consequences for that. So that led to the next sin, because seeing how easy it was to get away with the first one, it was easy for me to try to get away with the next one. So murder always begins where we allow Satan into our life that first time. And he's always hanging around trying to get in. God told Cain, when God rejected Cain's worship there in Genesis chapter 4, listen, just do what I tell you, and if you don't, Satan, sin, is right there at the door, just waiting to get in. Well, sin gets into our life. And then that leads to the second stage of murder, which is selfishness. We become the most important thing. It's not what you think or God thinks. It's what I think. I'm going to do what I want to do. And if I want to be angry at somebody without a cause, I will be. That's how Christ starts in verse 21 when he says, verse 22, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause. That's what would happen to Jesus. At the end of the gospel story, he told his men that the Jews hated him without a cause. When we're selfish, we don't need a reason to be angry or upset at someone. If they've simply refused to acknowledge our will, what we want, how we want to see something done, that's all it takes, and we're angry. But it doesn't stop there. Anger then leads to looking with contempt on our brother. And Christ illustrates this by two terms. If you say to your brother, Reka, which means you idiot, if you attack his intelligence, here's what they said about Paul in Athens. They called him a babbler, which translated would mean a bird brain. That's what the philosophers in Athens called Paul. They called him an idiot. Paul says when you have contempt for another, and to have contempt for another is to consider them worthless. They have no value. When you insult their intelligence, when you insult their heart, if you call your brother a fool, that's what Judas did at that supper that was held in the house of Simon the leper. Christ is sitting there, and Mary Magdalene, or not Mary Magdalene, but Mary the sister of Lazarus comes in, breaks an alabaster bottle, and pours a perfume that cost a year's salary. I don't know how much you make a year, what your income is. But imagine taking your income, buying a bottle of perfume, and then you open it up and pour it out on somebody's head. A year's salary down the drain. That's how Judas saw it. He said, what a waste. Mary, you fool, to waste that money like that. When we allow sin in, when we set ourselves up as the most important thing in the world, when we begin insulting our fellow by saying, I'm going to be angry with you, I don't need a reason, and you're an idiot, and you're a fool, The next stage is hatred that results in murder. Christ is teaching that murder involves not only the act of murder, it involves everything that leads up to the act, including unjustified anger and hatred. Now, you're not thrown in jail for hating people. Maybe you are in some places. Some places have what's called hate crimes. And hate crimes is more an attempt to control political speech than hate. But most jurisdictions don't throw you in jail for being angry with someone without a cause. We just don't go there. But our thoughts can be as much murder as an unborn child is a human being. I believe a child in the womb is as much a child as a child that has been delivered, that has been born. And in the same way, our thoughts about another can be as much murder as the actual taking of their life. That's what John said in 1 John 3:15. He said, "We hate our brother, we have murdered." And so Christ, who came to fulfill the law, shows that thou shalt not kill means a whole lot more than what the rabbis, the Pharisees, and the scribes were saying about it, and probably a whole lot more than what we think about it. It involves not just our deeds, it involves our emotions, our thoughts that presage the deed. But Christ doesn't stop there. He's going to show that not only does the command, thou shalt not kill, involve you as an individual, it also involves your responsibility to another, your responsibility to your brother. Christ will say in the Gospel of Matthew that the chief commandment is love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and then love your brother, your neighbor, as yourself. Thou shalt not kill involved our neighbor. Not just the one we want to kill, but the one who wants to kill us. Now, how many rabbis were explaining thou shalt not kill in those terms? Probably none of them. And probably not many Bible teachers or us in our meditating about thou shalt not kill think about those wanting to kill us as being our responsibility. But Christ is going to show that it is. And he does that by using the word therefore. Verse 23, therefore, after talking about anger without a cause and calling a man an idiot, calling him a fool, therefore. And then he talks about something that seems to be completely unrelated. He says, you've gone to church. You bring your gift to the altar. We would say you go to church. You go to church, you're planning to worship, and you remember that some brother is upset with you about something. Christ says, when you remember that, you stop what you're doing, you go find your brother who's upset with you, and you patch things up. You be reconciled to him. According to Jesus, that's part of the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. You know, when your finger gets a splinter, your foot does not say, finger, you should have been more careful. You shouldn't have been so clumsy. You should have put on a pair of gloves. That's not what the foot thinks or says when the finger gets a splinter. No, the foot is involved with the rest of the body then in rushing to the injury to make sure that infection doesn't start, resulting in sepsis. The whole body is engaged in fighting off the harm that's been done to the finger. And in the same way, In the body of Christ, when one brother has been injured by sin, and in this case, it's a sin where he's angry with me about something. He's upset with me. My reaction as part of the body, the reaction of everybody as part of the body, is to focus attention on the injured part and restore health and wholeness. And if we're unwilling to see that, if we're unwilling to do that, then we, our righteousness, has not exceeded the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. We're doing no more than they did. So let's talk about this now in just a little bit more detail. You're on your way to church. You remember somebody's got something against you. He's unhappy with you for some reason. And you say, well, that's his problem. I didn't do anything. He may be angry with me without a cause. I didn't cause him to be angry. That's his problem. He needs to address that. And we don't say anything to him. Or we ignore him. No, that's not what Christ says. What he says is even more shocking than simply saying, no, you've got a responsibility here. Because what he says is, being reconciled to a brother is more important than going to church. Years ago when I was in Nashville, we were studying this passage. And one of the best men in the congregation, I revered this man. He lived almost 100. His wife lived, I think, 101. And he was probably around 80, early 80s then. I remember after the class or the sermon, whatever it was, saying, man, I just don't think that reconciliation is more important than worship. I don't think anything's more important than worship. Nothing should ever keep you from worship. And all I can do is repeat to you what Christ says here. First, be reconciled to your brother, then come and offer your gift. Then go back to church and worship God there. First and then. That shows priority. And we shouldn't reverse God's priority. When Christ says, this is what you do first, and this is what you do second, that should be the order we observe. And according to Christ, who is the head of the church, he says the body being in unity, union, properly related to one another, is more important than going into church and somebody over here is mad at the person back there and they're not talking to each other about it and they give each other the cold shoulder and they have no sympathy for one another, but they're at worship, both of them, despite the bad blood that exists between them. Christ says, no. You get right with your brother even if you've done nothing. Well, why is it my obligation to go find a grouch, find someone who's angry for no reason with me? Why is that my job? Because you're his brother. And he's in a situation now where he doesn't have the good sense to see the situation he's in. And your job is to help bring him back to the light and bring him back to good sense and bring him back into relationship. To be reconciled means to be made friends again. You've been like this, but something happens and now you're like this. And Christ is saying, you've got to get like this again. And you are responsible for taking the first step. Now, he's the one who's got the problem, not me. Let him take care of his own mess. No, that's not what Christ says. It doesn't matter if we are the problem or our brother is the problem. Matthew chapter 18, verse 15, Christ says, if you've got a problem with your brother, you go to him, and between you and him, you patch things up. You get it worked out. That's Matthew 18. But here in Matthew 5, Christ says, your brother's got a problem with you. You're okay with him, but he's not okay with you. Doesn't matter. You go to him. Christ says, it doesn't matter if you've wronged someone or they've wronged you, you go first. And in doing that, you're acting like Christ, who is love. God is love. 1 John 4:10. Herein is love, not that we loved him, but that he loved us. God doesn't love us because, we don't love God first. God doesn't love us because we loved him first. He loved us first. Our love is a response to his. If we're going to be like Christ, if we're going to act in love, we will always take the first step toward being reconciled. And to go off in the corner and to swell up like a toad and to say of someone, well, they did this, they know what they did, they need to come and ask my forgiveness, they need to come and make things right. That's not exceeding the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. It's certainly not what Christ taught. First, in Matthew chapter 7, Christ is going to say, those who like to criticize other people. You know, it's amazing. Bring up any name, and there are people who have a dozen criticisms they can level against whomever you bring up on the spot. They'll have something negative to say. They'll have some gripe, some complaint. Ask them to bring up a dozen things they're guilty of. Ask them to use the same yardstick against themselves that they use against everybody else. Christ says to those people who are hypercritical and hypocritical, first, cast the beam out of your own eye. I was reading a man the other day who said in his enthusiasm to rid other people of the demons in their life, he overlooked the demons living in him. And he said, in his concern to help others have prim and proper trimmed and tidy gardens, his was overrun with weeds. First, cast the beam out of your eye, and then help your brother with the speck of sawdust in his. First be reconciled, and then go back and offer your gift. Where there's been a breakup, we individually as Christians are responsible for initiating the makeup. Well, what if they don't want to be made up? Well, in those cases, as much as lies within you, live peaceable with all men. Paul had a guy by the name of Alexander the coppersmith, who Paul says did me much harm. He resisted our words. Apparently Paul sought reconciliation and Alexander wasn't having nothing to do with it. I'll let the Lord deal with him, Paul says. But as much as lies within us, if you know someone now who is upset with you, if there's someone you're upset with, get it fixed. Because Christ concludes in verses 25 and 26 by saying this: it's smart to get a plea bargain. The smart move is to get a plea bargain. The reason lawyers urge you, if you go to a lawyer, you've been accused of a crime, the reason they urge you to accept a plea bargain is because you never know what the jury's going to do. Doesn't matter how innocent you are, the jury, for whatever reason, might decide you're guilty. And it's better to work out something you can live with, even if it's imprisonment, than to risk the jury throwing you in prison for life, or the judge giving you a life sentence or worse for what you've done. While we have it within our own power to resolve a matter, to work it out, and the Christian is going to be ready to take the short end of the deal. In order to work out problems between you and someone else, you're going to be willing, and this is the second half of 1 John 4:10, you're going to be willing to take the blame. Love not only takes the first step, 1 John 4:10, love takes the blame. Christ took the blame. He took upon Him our sin. He took upon Him our penalty in order to be reconciled to us. And all of that, our thoughts, our feelings, our attitudes toward another, what efforts we make or don't make to be reconciled with another, all of that fit under that sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill. Christ showing us what it means to fulfill that commandment, what it means to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. So that's just the first illustration. And Lord willing, next week we'll move on to the second, where we move from murder to adultery. I mean, Christ takes the two sins most say are the big sins, murder and adultery. Those are the two big sins, and Christ is going to talk about them first.